From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lawrence Wright wasn't interested in writing an exposé about Scientology. As he points out, it's already one of the most stigmatized religions in the world. Its strange cosmology, the demands it puts on its members, its aggressive and vindictive behavior. What Wright wanted to know was why seemingly rational people would believe the things Scientologists believe. Wright says he spent much of his career exploring the effects of religious belief on people's lives, and that's at the heart of his book called Going Clear, which is the basis of the documentary film airing now on HBO. We're rebroadcasting our conversation today with Lawrence Wright. He tells the story of Scientology through the lives of its founder, its adherents, and some of its defectors. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to rebroadcast a conversation with the journalist Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His book, Going Clear, investigates the Church of Scientology. Wright says the book is more than an expose about the inner workings of the church, though he does write about the strange cosmology, its vindictive behavior, the stories of abuse on rank-and-file members. Really, Wright said he wanted to understand what made Scientology so appealing and what it was the believers got out of it. The book is the basis of a documentary by filmmaker Alex Gibney, which premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's currently airing on HBO. We'll give you details about that as we go along. In Going Clear, Wright explains he spends a good deal of time examining the effects of religious beliefs on people's lives, and he says there's several reasons why that's so interesting to him.
I was religious when I was a teenager. I was, you know, very pious in Dallas, Texas, and I moved away from that, but as a journalist, I became very fascinated with the fact that religion plays such an enormous role in transforming individuals and societies, far more so in many respects than politics. I think oftentimes we can hold political ideas that have very little to do with our behavior, but holding profound religious ideas is different. It can often be quite transformative.
I read a profile of you in the New York Times, which talked about how busy you had been, I guess still are, working on books and plays and learning how to play the piano. And the piece quotes you as saying that you had decided a while ago that you would only do things that are either really important or really fun. So which was the Scientology book?
Well, it started out as just being, I thought, important. What drew me to it, I mean, one of the things that's so fascinating about America is you can believe anything you want.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cultures that I've been in where that's not true. You can believe one thing more or less. But in America, you have this immense supermarket of beliefs. And you can go pick out any belief that you would like or create your own. And so it raises the question, what draws people to one belief rather than another? You know, why would you become, for instance, a Scientologist rather than, if you wanted a different belief, a Jehovah's Witness or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, why do you pick one thing off the shelf rather than another? And Scientology seemed like an excellent study for me because it's certainly the most stigmatized religion in America today. And, why people would go into such an organization was really puzzling to me.
Well, you mentioned the stigma, which explains, I guess, in some ways, the fact that this book is not, at least as you see it, a kind of an expose. It's something different than that. It's more an exploration of that question you were talking about. How is it that they come to believe the way they do, I guess?
Right. It would have been pointless to write an expose of Scientology. That's practically the only coverage that Scientology has gotten. But still, people are drawn into the church, despite the negative public relations that it has. And so, you know, I thought there must be something involved in Scientology that is appealing to people and offers them something that other religions may not. And that was the source of my interest to begin with.
One thing that you've said is, despite its reputation, what the Church of Scientology has more of than almost anything is money and lawyers. I think you put that tongue-in-cheek.
Right, yes, that's true.
But it does raise the question, of course, that you must have thought about a good bit going into something like this. Were you ever, how nervous were you about the idea that they're pretty litigious at times and they can, you know, they seek in many ways. There are even stories of the church trying to ruin those who write books like these.
Well, it's not; those aren't just stories. Those were, you know, historical events.
Yeah.
The church has a well-earned history for being vindictive and litigious towards its critics and defectors and other reporters. It was in my mind, and when I first talked to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, about doing a story on Scientology, we were both aware of, for instance, in 1991, Time magazine published an expose of Scientology, and the church sued Time magazine. The suit lasted for nearly a decade, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Church of Scientology lost at every step along the way. But it was the most expensive suit that Time magazine ever defended in its entire history. So that was in our minds. And, of course, the reporter on that case was followed by private investigators, and his phone records were, you know, illegally seized. And, you know, he was one of many people who have written about the church who have been persecuted because of that.
There's a story you tell in the book about representatives, among them Tommy Davis, who was then the spokesperson for one of the spokespeople for Scientology, coming to the New York offices of the New Yorker magazine. You and David Remnick and others in with the New Yorker were on one side of the table. You have Tommy Davis and others on the other side of the table. And I'm not sure if it was actually present then, but Tommy Davis brings with him, because you're going to be talking about the content of this article. It wasn't a book yet, as I understand it anyway. And he brings with him, as I understand it, 48 three-ring binders.
Yeah, you know, I had talked to Tommy early, you know, when I first started this story, and he was reluctant to talk, but he agreed. He said he was going to take me through Scientology. Yeah. And in order to allow enough time, he wanted me to come out over Memorial Day 2010, the Memorial Day weekend. And I spent 2 nights cooling my heels in the hotel and not getting any responses. And finally, on Sunday, he came out to tell me that he wasn't going to take me through Scientology. He wasn't going to talk to me at all. He just wanted to have the opportunity to say that face to face, which, you know, it was a little irritating. But he agreed to answer fact-checking queries. And I don't know if he really understood how significant that is at The New Yorker. Our first round of fact-checking queries, 971 questions. And that elicited this trip that Tommy and his wife and assistant, Jessica Feshbach, plus 4 Scientology lawyers, made to New Yorker offices with all those binders in response to my queries. He also brought along a pie chart that demonstrated that the 970 of the 971 questions we had, 68% of them were false, and I didn't know what he meant. They were questions,
yeah.
You know. But we spent the entire day. It was essentially an interview, the only one I was really allowed to have with a church executive, and spent the whole day going through all of this. And with all the supporting material, I realized that actually, there might be a larger project. In fact, Remnick pulled me aside during one of our bathroom breaks and said, you know what you've got here, you schmuck. You've got a book.
Right.
And I had pretty much come to the same conclusion.
I wonder if it was at all different for you, or difficult in many ways, writing about There are a lot of kind of tawdry things that go into a story like this. You know, there is an element of gossip about the eccentricities of celebrities and famous people.
Right.
How did you decide to handle that part of this story?
Well, it is awkward. I mean, you know, diving into a really gray area of journalism when you start writing about celebrities,
yeah.
And I have an aversion to it. On the other hand, I saw this as being, you know, a very significant and important story. And the fact that key celebrities in American culture lend their names to this highly stigmatized religion was certainly a part of the story. And the more I got into it, the more I realized that some of these celebrities have enormous amounts of control in the church and derive extraordinary benefits from their membership. So it became less about, you know, the fact that I'm writing about Hollywood celebrities is I'm writing about people that are significant figures in the church that I'm actually covering.
Mm-hmm. What do we know in actual numbers about Scientology? I mean, officials from the church say it's the fastest growing religion in the world, but it seems like you hear that from a lot of different religions. You know, they won't release any official membership numbers. They say 8 million or something like that. But then you say there's an organization the church, you know, forcefully encourages people to join that only has something like 30. What do we know about the numbers?
Well, you know, as you say, I mean, poll data shows that maybe 25,000 people identify themselves as in the United States as Scientology, as Scientologists, which is less than half the number of Rastafarians,
right.
And 30,000 are in the whole world and members of the International Association of Scientologists. And, you know, the church claims up to 10 million members. So, you know, the range is somewhere between 30,000 and 10 million. I think there are more than 30,000 because I've been very impressed in the process of researching this. And subsequently, when the book has come out, by the number of people that have reached out to me and come to my talks and so on, by the significance of the significant damage that has been done to so many families because of the church's policy of forceful disconnection. And I've heard so many stories that I think is a bigger phenomenon than the 30,000, but not nearly as consequential as 10 million.
Why do you figure we care so much about this? Why are we so intrigued by it? A lot of people are. There aren't that many members in the scheme of things. What is interesting about Scientologists? There's a lot, I guess.
Well, there are several different things. You know, the celebrity aspect is one. You and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation if there weren't celebrities involved in it. And then there's the esoteric, rather bizarre belief system, which is very fascinating to people because the question I get again and again about Scientology is how could, you know, intelligent people, skeptical people, be involved in such things? And how could they believe that? And then there's this secretiveness, this kind of furtive and secretive aspect that the church has that tends to aggressively protect its secrets and fight so openly to keep from disclosing any kind of real information. So those three things make it very intriguing.
Let's talk about Paul Haggis. He turns out to be what I think you've called your donkey, the character who's strong and sympathetic enough to carry the story. He's only one of the characters, of course, in the book, and we'll get to a number of others. But let's talk about him first. He is a very successful writer and director from London, Ontario. When he was 21 years old, you tell the story about someone in, I think it's a record store, convinces him to buy L. Ron Hubbard's book, Dianetics. Talk about Paul Haggis, if you would.
One of the reasons I was drawn to Paul is that, first of all, he's a two-time Academy Award-winning writer and director. So he is a part of the Hollywood scene that is so identified with Scientology. But also, he's an intelligent, creative, and skeptical individual, exactly the kind of person that I wanted the reader to have to identify with. Because if you're not a little threatened by the idea that you also could be a person who would go into such an organization, then I haven't done my job. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that the reader feel like Scientologists are like us. They're like me. You know, anyone could be a Scientologist. Maybe not true as a blanket statement, but if somebody like Paul Haggis could be a Scientologist, then the reader would have to say, maybe it could happen to me as well, and then drop some of the prejudgment that is a part of the general consensus about Scientology. And that's why Paul was such a great way into the story, because the reader identifies with the fact that he's, you know, he's a real interesting individual, and he's, you know, he's a compelling figure. And as a donkey, I have to say, he's one of the best I ever had the chance to work with.
He's such a natural skeptic. I mean, you write about how he constantly struggles to believe. This is how he admits this to the people who are auditing him. He thinks of himself in some ways as kind of a fraud in terms of Scientology. He's always struggling with this. But what's interesting is when he comes to Scientology, he's an atheist at the time. And at first, he's interested because he wants to make a documentary about it. It seems, I guess, in some ways to him, silly but fascinating. And then he gets drawn into the idea through this process that you write about called the dissemination drill, which is interesting because it tells a little bit about how Scientology really goes about trying to disarm people like Paul Haggis.
Well, he went into this, you know, out of curiosity. But when you go into a Scientology church for the first time, you will be asked, you know, what is your ruin? In other words, what is standing in the way of your economic progress, your spiritual progress, your relationships? You know, what is it that is keeping you from realizing yourself as a, you know, as a larger human being? And in Paul's case, he had a, you know, he had some relationship problems with his girlfriend, and when you, you know, go into the church will have a menu of courses that could address any of these problems. And indeed, Paul and his girlfriend at the time, later his wife, Diane, joined this church, and they began taking a communications course, and they felt that it helped them.
Yeah.
And it's true for many people when they get into Scientology at that level. It doesn't have anything to do with the belief system of Scientology. It has to do with the fact that they're looking for some kind of help on a personal level.
Yeah.
And, you know, even people who, you know, no longer are involved in Scientology, like, for instance, Jerry Seinfeld, who took a communications course at a Church of Scientology, and he credits it with helping him have the confidence to become a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
I don't question the idea that Scientology can be helpful at that level. There's also a therapy, which is in Scientology called auditing.
Right.
It's a different process than the usual psychotherapy that a person might undergo, especially made different by the fact that between you and the auditor, as they call it in Scientology, there is a this machine called an e-meter.
Yeah.
Those are two tin cans. They used to be Campbell's soup cans with the labels scraped off.
Yeah.
And they're connected by electrical wires to a meter with a needle on it. And a small current, indetectable, passes through it. It's one-third of a lie detector. It measures your galvanic skin response. And you can imagine that the therapeutic relationship is somewhat different when you have a lie detector placed in between the therapist and the subject. And this e-meter is very powerful in terms of how people respond to it. Paul felt that it was kind of uncanny. What it really does, it just measures, you know, the sweat in your palms and also movement in your fingers and so on. But Scientologists think that it actually measures the mass of your thoughts.
Right.
There's no evidence scientifically that thoughts have mass. But in Scientology, this is the concept. And the idea is that this e-meter is so powerful it can probe through your subconscious and find things that you don't even know to be true. And, for instance, past lives, you know, these oftentimes surface during these auditing sessions. And the fact that the e-meter is there validating it gives it a tremendous amount of power in the minds of a lot of these people that take those courses.
Seems as though part of the appeal is also this, and I guess in some way this is, may have been appealing to Haggis, to Paul Haggis, is the sense of rationalism. Scientologists believe that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, didn't come to the truth, as you put it, through revelation, but through this more rational process of research. He did his research, and he found the secret to existence, I guess. And in some ways, they see that's the science part, I suppose.
Exactly. They say that Scientology is not faith-based, which raises the question of, you know, why it's a religion. But they say it's a technology, and that you subscribe to this, you go up the ladder of spiritual attainment inside Scientology, and it's a guaranteed process, step by step, that leads to spiritual enlightenment. It's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of simply applying the correct principles that L. Ron Hubbard discovered in his highly eccentric research system.
Yeah, yeah. The language they use is unequivocal. Two, Hubbard had found a perfect understanding. Scientology works 100% of the time, mm-hmm. certain and exact. And you say in the book that Scientology is this is how you put it, the geography of Hubbard's brain.
Yeah, it's L. Ron Hubbard, you know, for one thing, he wrote faster than he wrote 100,000 words a month when he was working for the pulp magazines in the 30s and 40s. And he holds the Guinness Book of World Records on the number of books published, more than 1,000. And the preponderance of his work is his explorations into his own mind that became Scientology. I don't think anybody ever spent as much time probing his inner thoughts than L. Ron Hubbard. And Scientology, his creation, is really an exploration of his own mentality. And it is a totalistic universe. Every question you have has been answered by Hubbard's inner explorations. So the deeper you get into Scientology, the more like L. Ron Hubbard you will become in many respects.
Mm. Lawrence Wright. His book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. It's the basis of a documentary film by filmmaker Alex Gibney that's currently airing on HBO. There's a link for showtimes and more information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with journalist Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His book, Going Clear, is the basis of a new HBO documentary by filmmaker Alex Gibney, which explores the Church of Scientology. I wanted to ask you about, we were talking about L. Ron Hubbard before the break. Describe how Hubbard, as you put it in the book, how he hovers over the religion. I mean, the role he plays, because you say there seems to be early on, and I found this really interesting, two Hubbards within the church. There's that godlike authority who, you know, speaks scripture, basically. But then there's another Hubbard that you see on training videos who you talk about as being wry and really self-deprecating.
Yeah, I think that is the figure that people were initially drawn to. He had a, you know, charismatic presence. He was folksy. He was self-deprecating. He was ironic. Those are not qualities that you really associate with Scientology itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Hubbard was, he had a great way of drawing people to him. The thing about him that's so intriguing to me as a writer is that there are these two narratives about his life that are so diametrically opposed to each other. And one was a legend that Hubbard created about himself that the church still defends. And, in that one, he's the greatest individual ever made.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the legend that Hubbard made was that he, after World War II, he was he had served heroically in the Navy, and he was, because of his injuries, blinded and crippled and left in this hospital, this naval hospital in Oakland, and medicine couldn't do anything for him. So he healed himself using these techniques that he developed into Dianetics. Now, that's just one example, but I was able to get hold of his medical and service records, and he was never injured in the war. He did not serve with distinction, and he had ulcers and conjunctivitis, but he was scarcely crippled and blinded. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's why we have these two. You know, the Hubbard is a fraud, that is the anti-Scientology view, and Hubbard is a demigod, which is the Scientology view. And exploring the contrast between those two visions was part of the real delight for me as a writer and a reporter.
There is an extraordinary story you tell toward the end of the book where you're talking to Tommy Davis, among others, there at that meeting you were referring to earlier. And Davis talks about the question of Hubbard's war record. And you say that he says something that everyone on the New Yorker side of the table were just kind of stunned by. He said that if Hubbard had not been injured in the war, then essentially Dianetics is a fraud and Scientology, I suppose, in essence, was based on a lie. You were really surprised by that. Talk about your response.
Well,
to that.
Yeah, it seemed like a provable hypothesis.
Yeah.
Because we had already filed a Freedom of Information request with the military archives in St. Louis. And after Tommy made that statement, we sent an intern to St. Louis to speed things along, and she was able to get the 900 pages of his military service records. And I asked Tommy about, you know, the fact that there's just no evidence in the files that Hubbard had this distinguished career, and he said that, well, they were also puzzled by that, and that they consulted a former Defense Department guy who told them that Hubbard's records had been sheep-dipped, which a term I had not heard before, but the idea was that he was actually an intelligence agent, and there were other records somewhere that would prove that. And yet the church was never able to produce anything that substantiated the notion that he was an intelligence agent who had records that were sheep-dipped. In fact, they sent me medals that he, you know, a photograph of medals he supposedly earned. And there was also a it's sort of like a discharge paper, his end of service thing, with all these credits about how he had served here and there. And when we got his military records, there was another one of those discharge papers, which completely opposite to the one that the church gave me. And there were little details on there. The medals earned, for instance, some of the, you know, they were listed on the church's version of the discharge. Some of those medals hadn't been created at the time that Hubbard was in the service. Some of them were foreign medals that had never been awarded to Americans. And they didn't even correlate with the photograph of the medals that the church sent to me. So there were numerous examples of what one of the archivists in St. Louis said was an obvious fraud.
Yeah. It's interesting to compare the Scientology of today, which seems rigorous and, as you put it, vindictive, compare that to the Scientology of the 1970s, which seemed to be the Scientology that was appealing to a person like Paul Haggis, because he seemed to really like the more playful L. Ron Hubbard, the idea that he seemed to be winking at the audience when he was talking about these things. And Scientology of the 70s, you said, had a kind of playful and giddy air. Did it change? At what point did it start to shift, do you think?
Well, you know, it's true that in the 70s, Scientology had reached a kind of apex, especially in L.A. It was a part of the counterculture And it was a drug-free version of it.
Right.
In fact, you know, that was part of the appeal, I think. Scientology offered a lot of the same kind of countercultural experiences, but without, you know, the consequences that drugs sometimes imposed on people. And by that time, Hubbard had set up the Celebrity Center in Hollywood, and the whole idea that Scientology was at the center of this kind of celebrity culture that we were developing was a big feature of the church. I think that things really began to change. Two things happened. One was that in 1980, L. Ron Hubbard went into hiding, and where he stayed until his death 6 years later. And so he was off the scene, and the, you know, church became a little rudderless, and his paranoia had sort of taken control. There was a huge raid on the church in 1977 by the FBI, which had been tipped off that Scientology had infiltrated government offices, and when they conducted this raid, they were stunned to discover that more than 5,000 Scientologists had been deployed to infiltrate the Justice Department, the FBI, the Food and Drug Administration, the IRS, and also newspapers like the Washington Post and foreign governments as well, and the American Psychological Association. I mean, it was extraordinary. In our entire history, nothing like that had ever occurred. So at that point, you know, there was a tremendous public turn against the church. And Hubbard went into hiding, and then in middle 80s, one of the worst blows that the church ever sustained was that some of their secret doctrines were dumped into a court record, and suddenly everybody had heard about Xenu and the Galactic Overlord and everything. This was the most secret doctrine of the church, and it was something that people paid very dearly to learn about, and then it was no longer a secret.
Yeah. It's interesting. David Miscavige comes on the scene, young and intense, and his reaction to Hubbard's death, which you write about, is interesting because he mentions that he doesn't want to see any of this grief nonsense. That's not the word he used. But and there's one report that you talk about how he was happy and joking. What explains that, this experience after? What is he happy about? What's he joking about? Do we know?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
There is one way from the Scientology perspective, the one that Miscavige propagated, was that Hubbard had dropped his body and had gone on to a higher level of research. And therefore, why grieve? You know, he had transcended in some respects. And that he would come back. He would be reincarnated at some future date. And there's another view, which is, you know, David Miscavige was posed to take over, which he actually did.
Yeah. Do you think you write about, you know, how every new religion faces that crisis after the death of a charismatic founder? You mentioned how Paul kept Christianity alive after Jesus. You mentioned how Brigham Young kept Mormonism alive after Joseph Smith. It becomes Miscavige's church in some way, and you write about his role. You talk about how he knew his talents, how he knew his limitations, and he didn't claim to be a prophet. You say he saw his job as not as a leader as much as the whip.
Right. And yet, there were designated successors. Pat and Annie Broker were the people who had taken care of L. Ron Hubbard in his last days, and he had more or less signaled that they were the ones that were going to be his successors. But the truth is that they were both relatively weak personalities, and it wasn't that difficult for David Miscavige to shove them aside. It's certainly true that Scientology would not have survived if Miscavige had not been able to succeed in gaining a tax exemption for the church. And it may be that he was the only one that could have done that. And in that sense, he really is the savior of Scientology. But the way that he went about that, by 1993, Hubbard had decided not to pay taxes. So by 1993, the church owed more than $1 billion in back taxes, and it didn't have $1 billion. So this was an existential moment for the church. It had to get a tax exemption or it would cease to exist. The way that David Miscavige went about doing that was to launch more than 2,300 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents and hire private investigators to follow agents around, see who was drinking too much, who was unfaithful to his spouse, and whatever the merits of it. And let's admit that the IRS is scarcely qualified to make such distinctions about what is a religion and what is a cult and so on. Mm-hmm. But it's the only agency whose opinion really matters,
right?
Because you and I can quarrel over these things, but it's the IRS that makes the determination. So whatever the merits of the case, part of the deal was that those lawsuits would be dropped, the private investigators would be called off, and in return the $1 billion was forgiven. And the church received the status of being a religious community, which meant that it received the extraordinary protections of the First Amendment of the Constitution, the guarantees of religious liberty, which comfort it now.
Did you ever wonder, when you were reporting this story, did you ever wonder whether or not David Miscavige actually believed Scientology?
Well, no, I think he probably believes in it, but he'd never really he never actually pursued the going up the Scientology pyramid.
Yeah.
So maybe he thought it was unnecessary for him, but that part of the church didn't seem to carry very much appeal to him. I think he sees himself more as an executive than as a spiritual leader.
Lawrence Wright, he's the author of Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. The book is the basis for Alex Gibney's documentary, which is currently airing on HBO. You can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for a schedule and more information. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the journalist Lawrence Wright. His investigation into the Church of Scientology is the basis for a new documentary by the filmmaker Alex Gibney. It's currently airing on HBO. We'll give you details about that at the end of the program. Wright's book is called Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. I wanted to ask you about how is it that you explain the particular allure of Scientology for, for creative people, lots of writers and filmmakers and artists? I mean, it's interesting you write about how the people who have actually investigated Scientology, William Burroughs surprised me. You mentioned Jerry Seinfeld. There was Christopher Reeve and Lou Rawls and Leonard Cohen was interesting, Sonny Bono. How is it that celebrities came to be an important part of Scientology? What do they see in it, do you think?
Well, to start with, this is a church that was built for celebrities. When Hubbard began the Church of Scientology in 1954, he located it in Los Angeles, and then he started the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. Early on in the church's history, there was a roster published of prospective Scientologists, and we want these celebrity members. They were Walt Disney, Bob Hope, Marlena Dietrich, Howard Hughes. I mean, some of the most famous people in the world. Mm. But the idea was to take over the entertainment industry. Hubbard had I think, a brilliant insight that celebrity was itself an object of worship in the United States, and Hollywood was his main temple. So he built a church that would draw in celebrities, and they sought them out. And even today, you know, there is such a thing known as central casting. It's where aspiring actors go to get parts as extras. And, you know, there'll be, you know, Scientologists out passing out brochures in the queue, how to get ahead in the industry, how to get an agent, and so on. The whole idea of courting celebrities and potential celebrities is a part of the church's strategy. And it's also, you know, they coddle celebrities and treat them the way that they feel like they ought to be treated. Moreover, when they do get people into the church, such as Tom Cruise or, you know, Ann Archer, or, you know,
John Travolta,
many of these, many of these people, young people that are going into the industry look at them and say, well, now wait, you know, John Travolta and Tom Cruise and Will Smith, who says he's not a Scientologist but has created a school that is based on Hubbard's educational principles. Each of these men at one point in his career was the number one leading man in the world. Now, that's a very powerful advertisement, and that is testimony to the church's strategy that celebrity sells.
Miscavige really understood this, you write about, that he understood this need to nourish the ego of celebrities, to deal with the conflict about loving privacy on one hand and wanting attention on the other. And you write about this, the need, you write, or the sense that the qualities of the material world that surround you reflect upon your own value, and therefore everything must be made perfect. This was something Miscavige seemed to, you say, really understand.
And certainly Tom Cruise is the main beneficiary of that courtship that Miscavige has lavished on celebrities, but especially Cruise. Certainly Tom Cruise has given a lot of money to the church. But it's also true that he's received quite a lot of material benefit from his membership. You know, we haven't talked about the fact that there is this clergy inside the church called the Sea Org, or Sea Organization. And these are people who have signed a billion-year contract of service because they believe they'll come back lifetime after lifetime. They are paid $50 a week. They often join as children and sacrifice their education. So they're, you know, they are supposed to be the kind of priests and nuns of the church. But Cruise has been given the labor a lot of these by of a lot of these people. They built an airplane hangar for his airplane collection. They handcrafted a limousine for him, you know, they painted his motorcycles, they, you know, refurbished his house. I mean, you know, cooked his Thanksgiving dinner and catered his wedding. I mean, again and again, you see that he has enjoyed the use of these clerical, impoverished, poorly educated people to gain his personal benefit. And I think he's got a certain responsibility to examine the kinds of things that are going on inside the church, because he's the chief salesperson.
This is, I guess, where we get to this idea of the this prison of belief. Because, you know, these people, for the most part, I guess, I think there are important exceptions, but for the most part, they're there because they choose to be there.
Right.
And you talk about those who leave, who blow, and there are a number of stories about this, but you talk about how when they when a security team often goes after them, that they're torn by these emotions that they have. On one hand, they're angry and hurt. Many times they're abused and, you know, degraded. But on the other hand, they also believe, and I think this is true of a lot of religious people, that their eternal salvation is at stake.
Right.
And so you say that these security teams often appeal to that residual idealism that they still have with them. I guess this is that prison of belief. This is that will that they want to believe.
You know, an example of what I mean by that, The Sea Org International headquarters is in a desert compound in Southern California, a very remote spot, and it's where David Miscavige maintains his main residence, and that's where the executive tier of the clerical group is organized. And in 2006, Miscavige took these two, they were double-wide trailers that had been married together into a kind of office suite, and he had all the furniture taken out, and he began confining his top executives there, at one point more than 100 of them, sleeping on the floor, ant-infested, lots of physical abuse. They're supposed to spend their day confessing their crimes to each other, and one person was, for instance, made to mop the toilet floor with his tongue. You know, those kinds of abuses were common. And one night, Miscavige walks in with a jam box, and he has chairs brought in, and he says that we're gonna play musical chairs, and the last person remaining will get to stay, and everybody else is going to be kicked out or sent off to some remote location. Husbands and wives will be separated. And to give reality to this idea, he actually had airline tickets printed up in the Scientology travel office. So, you know, he was playing Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. And whenever the music would stop and the number of chairs had diminished, people began to fight. Clothes were torn. Chairs were broken. And what was so striking to me, you know, some of these people had been in the hole, as they called it, for years. And they were fighting to stay there. I found that really, really telling, a comment on the mentality of the people that are inside that and how few options they have. And I started thinking about, why would people fight to stay in confinement like that? You know, they had been inculcated with the idea that the outside world was hostile to Scientology and wouldn't understand them. They thought that Scientology was their salvation, but they were also typically poorly educated. They had no money. Most of their friends and family members were in Scientology, and were they to leave, those people would never talk to them again. Mm. Their options seemed so small, and so that's why they fought each other in order to stay in confinement.
A number of listeners have sort of drawn this parallel, which you write about, the connection between, compare Scientology to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. And you write about, I wanted you to talk about that if you wouldn't mind, because you write about how Mormonism really was able to, in many ways, I mean, it has very similar connections. It has a charismatic leader, a man who's been described as a liar, whose story doesn't always check out. And yet Mormonism, you say, evolves, goes on to become this, you know, one of the fastest growing denominations. It now is mainstream. And you write about it being kind of the measure not only of the religion's success, but this is how you put it, the ability of a faith to adapt and change. Is there a difference between Scientology and Mormonism in that way?
Well, if we think of these two religions as being similar in some respects but separated by 150 years of history, they're very similar. Mormonism was the most stigmatized religion in the 19th century, probably the most persecuted sect in our history.
Yeah.
There was actually a bill in Congress at one point to exterminate the Mormons. I mean, it was just, the hatred directed towards Mormons was simply unparalleled. And there was, you know, and of course the Mormon Church had the idea of setting up a theocracy, was, you know, opposed to America, and polygamy was one of the fundamental tenets of the religion, which was part of what made generated this widespread hostility.
Sure.
Outside of Utah. But one of the reasons that Mormonism changed is that it is structurally able to make those kinds of changes because the leader of the church is seen as a prophet and is able to make declarations such as, we no longer believe in polygamy.
Right.
And so the church turned, and it made a profound change in his history. So much so that now, you know, in the last election, we had two Mormons running to be president of the United States. Now, Scientology, it's got a lot of money, and it's got a lot of lawyers, as we've noted, but it's suffering in its membership. But were it to change, I think it's at a moment of crisis right now. And if it were to reform itself, as did the Church of Latter-day Saints in the 19th century, then somewhere down the road, I wouldn't put it out of the question that Scientology would become a more mainstream religion. What Scientology has going for it, which is somewhat like the Mormon experience, is that, you know, it's separated from the rest of society by esoteric beliefs. It's not, they're not, you know, they're not racial differences, they're not language differences. These religious beliefs are only separated, they're only defined by their beliefs. And if you step across a line and say, I believe this, you enter a community. And oftentimes, those religious communities can be very beautiful and supportive. I found, you know, I had written about the Mormons myself, and I was quite struck by how supportive the community of Mormons is, how it takes care of its own and others. And so there's something of that same quality inside Scientology. If the community, the religious community itself, is vibrant and thriving and self-supporting, then the quality of the beliefs, you know, doesn't really matter. People are members of it because of the community, not because of the beliefs.
Lawrence Wright. His book is called Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. It's the basis for a new documentary by director Alex Gibney, also called Going Clear. It's currently airing on HBO, and there are links to showtimes and more information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.